Hello, thank you for joining us. It's been an eerily quiet week in Ambridge because most of the villagers went on Peggy's ghastly family holiday to Scotland. Only half of them made it to the grand stately home, which turned out to be the grand stately stable block with bunk beds. In an act of sibling bonding, Lillian and Tony heroically cleared out the local whiskey distillery. Helen all but rolled in the hay with Finley, the Crofter-cum-firefighter, possibly the sexiest combination of jobs imaginable. And Vet Jacob distracted Phoebe from her labour pains with stories of mother hamsters who eat their young. We also got a new recruit to the clan, the tiniest member of the Aldridge dynasty, after 11 great-grandchildren. We finally met Peggy Woolley's first great-great-grandchild. I'm Emma Freud, and for BBC Sounds, this is The Archers Podcast. This week, we're looking at the magnificent matrilineal legacy of Peggy Woolley through the escapades of her daughters, granddaughters and great-great-granddaughters. To help us throw new light onto this labyrinthine family tree, I'm joined by Peggy's grandchild, Kate, the podcast favourite, Perdita Avery. Perdita, do you think Peggy knew that the mass family holiday was going to be a recipe for disaster, and that is actually why she put it into her will?
I'm sure she did. I don't think she could have possibly anticipated it going any other way with that bunch of people.
So it was a test, not a gift.
Yes.
Or even
she
penance.
She probably hoped they might grow or learn something. They won't.
The final act of mischief. They can't learn and grow because then we wouldn't have a programme to listen
exactly.
to.
Exactly.
We also have Peggy's great-granddaughter Phoebe, played by Lucy Morris, fresh from the maternity ward. Lucy, answer me this. All the couples were separated on the holiday and everyone, apart from Lillian, seemed happier without their partner. What does that teach us?
I think everybody just likes their own time. I know for Phoebe, she was obviously on her own because Brodie was working away right up until she gave birth. But I think it's nice to spend time with family in small doses.
It was terribly convenient, wasn't it, that Kate didn't pick up Brodie on the way to the maternity ward, because if she had, he would have had to speak. And he's never done that yet, has he?
No, not yet. But I think that's just classic Kate, just thinking about her own destination.
Oh, I don't know why you say that. Our guest of honour this week is the brilliant broadcaster and lifelong listener, Libby Purvis, who's here to shed some wise light on the matriarch. Libby, in your view, who behaved worst on the holiday? Who would Peggy have scolded first?
Well, Peggy probably wouldn't have scolded because she wasn't hard on the women. She was only ever hard on poor old Tony. So I think Kate obviously behaved worse because she always behaved worse because she's a nightmare. You know, she's basically a sort of poisonous yoga nut.
Thank you.
But I think that she's the only one who really behaved badly.
Justin seemed to have a personality transplant on this holiday. Jacob, as you say, was very relaxed. Is it Ambridge that makes them awful? If you take the awful ones out of the village, are they suddenly perfectly decent people?
Maybe that's part of it. But I always rather like Justin, actually. You know, if you're going to have a ferocious old gammon who owns everything and everybody, then you might as well do it thoroughly. You know, just exactly the way that if you're going to have a poisonous yoga nut like Kate, you might as well do that properly as well. They do it properly in the Archers. God bless them. Very few half measures, really.
Libby, you are such good value. My scene of the week was the true heart of the holiday. I chose it because it made me cry. 74 years after Peggy Archer arrived in Ambridge, on the trip she gave her family as a parting gift, we met her successor.
Oh, I'm so proud of you, Phoebs. I could burst.
I'm in complete awe.
Oh, hey, what about her name? Have you got one?
I wanted to wait for Mum.
Oh, there's no rush for names.
Brodie and I already decided that if it was a girl, we would call her Margaret.
Oh.
Or Peggy, for short.
Peggy?
Is that okay? I mean, we'll change it if you think that's the wrong thing.
No. It's wonderful. It's perfect. Oh, you are the most special, the most precious thing I've ever seen. Welcome to the world, my beautiful little Peggy.
Was it just me who cried?
Yep. We were all crying there.
No, you can hear I was crying.
We were. It was very emotional.
And I think I can see a tear in Libby Purvis's eye, but I'm not going to look too closely.
It was never going to be called Waynetta, was it?
If only, wouldn't that have been heaven? The reason it got to me was because in the 75th year of the Archers, and so soon after Peggy's death, to witness a new life arriving with 75 years of history and legacy that we've experienced, knowing that we're still going to know her in 75 years, just felt like an incredible... It was like the moment in Lion King where they hold the baby up, yes. Simba, yes. And you just go, this is who we are. This is the ancestry of Britain and this programme.
I had a slight sort of, and I thought, yeah, there's a number of grandchildren now. There's 7 of them. None of them called Peggy. But I thought, gosh, if somebody was, you know, how would that feel? Would it feel positive or would it feel negative? Quite hard to work out.
A burden or a gift?
Yeah.
Do we feel a stronger ownership over characters in The Archers when we hear them? The ones who we've actually met as babies. Does it mean that we feel we've raised them, we have a guardianship over them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when you have the characters and they're introduced from the very, very beginning, you grow with them and you see them get things right and get things wrong, and you see people wade in and have opinions and judgments on them all the way through their life. And so you'll sympathise with them and think that people were overly harsh and critical, or you'll just take to the character and want the best for them and root for them against all the odds. I wouldn't know how that feels because everyone is passionately against Kate, but I didn't introduce her as a little person. I think it's a really special thing when people kind of get to grow up in the show, and I think that's what's so magical about it being such a long-running show.
You've had your baby now, Lucy.
Yes.
I mean, you haven't, but
no.
Phoebe has.
I haven't.
Which qualities from your family legacy would you like her to inherit?
I think the women in the Aldridge family are a very strong-willed, and that's something that I think was instilled in us from Peggy, from Jennifer, and from Kate, you know? So definitely that characteristic. But also I know that there is definitely some negativity surrounding Kate, but she's so free-spirited and free-willed that I think it's really an important trait to have. And, you know, I think Phoebe has taken that on. She went to Scotland on her own. She did something that people didn't think she was going to do, just because, you know, she wanted to live her own life. And that sort of, I guess, mirroring Kate in a way, hopefully won't abandon her child. Sorry. but, you know, she is forging her own path, which Kate definitely did. So I would hope that Peggy, little Peggy, takes on those reins as well.
Thank you. We do just briefly need to take a moment to reassure one of our newer listeners, Carrie, who emailed us at thearcherspodcast@bbc.co.uk to say that after last week's episode, she was on tenterhooks as to what actually happened to the £40 of missing rent money that Simon had accused Susan of stealing. Was she innocent of all charges? Carrie, you can breathe again. Shula discovered the missing money 2 days later. Susan had put it in Simon's desk drawer. Of course she had. Now, earlier this year, the BBC hosted a memorial to commemorate the astonishing life of June Spencer, the actress who first played Peggy Woolley in 1951 and retired in 2022. She died last November at the age of 105. One of the highlights of the event was the eulogy by Libby Purvis. Libby, when you were asked to do a speech at that very grand memorial, how daunting was the request?
Slightly daunting, and I thought, and when the editor Jeremy Howe said, I want you to talk about Peggy in time, Peggy in history, and so I thought, oh, you know, should I basically go into all the prime ministers and what she would have thought of them all? And then I thought, no, I'll do something a bit different.
Well, you certainly did that, and we're about to explore it. What was the particular skill, do you think, that June Spencer brought to Peggy?
She was just 100% an actor who could make faces even on the radio. I think that's quite important. You could hear her pursing her lips sometimes. And she was a woman who'd seen a lot of life, really. You know, she'd been a child actor. You know, she wasn't a simpleton. And she was sort of given this woman with a very strong moral compass, you know, thought she was better than the vicar, you know, knew better, you know, and why couldn't he let her have her stained glass windows? And you could hear it sometimes in those just short little bits the short scenes, you could hear it in Peggy. I disliked her as a character very much because I thought she was a prig, but she did it just so brilliantly. And I mean, that's the joy of it. It's like Kate, you know, that it's so nice to be able to play somebody who you really wouldn't want to be stuck in a lift with. It's great.
Well, the part of your speech that left everyone in the room reeling was when you reminded us of the changes in behaviour that Peggy witnessed over her long life in Ambridge. You've kindly agreed to share that with us. But before we do that, let's just establish the world when Peggy first arrived in Ambridge. It had very different rules for women at that time. I mean, for example, many doctors advised sex only for procreation. A husband had conjugal rights to sex. A woman couldn't legally refuse until 1991, so marital rape was legal. A woman could be dismissed from her job for getting married or being pregnant. Do you remember that one, Libby?
Mm, yeah.
Many maternity hospitals separated respectable married mothers from unmarried mothers. Unmarried pregnant women were often pressurised to give up their babies for adoption. St Stephen's would have refused remarriage ceremonies in Ambridge at the time. If you were being remarried, you had to do it somewhere other than a church. Many landlords refused to rent to unmarried couples, and male homosexuality was illegal. But the good news is female homosexuality wasn't, because it didn't exist, according to Queen Victoria. So that was the world, that was the cultural background when Peggy got to Ambridge in 1951. And over the decades, Peggy's worldview had to change, as you explained so beautifully at the memorial.
Yes, well, it was a bit daunting, and frankly, in front of all these BBC grandees, to speak such filth as I had to. But the life of Peggy Archer did serve as a barometer of the times from the early 50s till now, apart from all the changes in farming, from horse-drawn ploughs to machinery to organics to rewilding. She also had to face up to what you might call the sexual rewilding of Britain. Because, as Emma's just said, in those days sex outside marriage was taboo, and the worst thing you could say about a woman was homewrecker. So I thought about the sexual rewilding of Britain, as seen by poor Peggy. First generation, daughter Jennifer, pregnant by the cowman, marrying, divorced, remarried, but adulterous. Lillian, breaking up Justin's marriage. Only Tony of her children has ever been faithfully married, and she doesn't actually like him. Move on a generation, and there's Adam marrying a bloke and buying a baby from a Bulgarian fruit picker. Kate giving birth at Glastonbury and dumping the baby to have two more in South Africa, and then leave them there to run a yoga business and shack up with the vet. Debbie divorced, Alice marrying the farrier in Vegas and then taking to drink and smashing the village shop, Helen having a donor baby alone, then banged up without bail for stabbing Rob in the stomach, her grandson Tom jilting two fiancés but getting one of them pregnant and then finally going off with a sharp Welsh businesswoman. Sexual rewilding everywhere. And as if that wasn't enough to dismay poor church-going Peggy, look sideways at her brother-in-law Phil's family. Shuler's many and various pre-vicar affairs. Elizabeth having an abortion and then stealing Shuler's boyfriend Nigel, and then when he dies coming off a roof, wrecking Roy Tucker's marriage. Peggy's great-nephew Freddie being banged up for drug dealing. Great-niece Lily breaking up her university tutor's marriage and then cheating on him. Bisexual step-grandson Rory selling sex to an older woman in London while seducing the lad at the vets. Peggy's other great-niece Pip has a baby by a dumped friends with benefits and then shacks up with the lesbian farm manager. Great-nephew Ben gets the local hairdresser Chelsea Horribin pregnant in a ditch and promptly has a breakdown for the trauma, because she has to have the abortion and get back behind the tea room counter, being working class. Talk about the rewilding of British sexual moralities. What a three quarters of a century it has been. The elders of Middle Britain, these 70 years, have been grateful to hear Peggy audibly pursing her lips or delivering a cold killer line. Younger ones have been reminded of how they look to these elders. No wonder she didn't leave this incontinent rabble all her money, but forced them to go on a troublesome mass holiday instead.
Oh, come on. It's just beautiful. It's so interesting hearing you say it again, Libby, and it was such a tour de force. in that it made me realise that Peggy had grown up with, you know, her own set of values, and she really did have to change. And when I think about little baby Peggy, she's coming into 2025 and the world as it is now. Imagine if she had to change her mind, her attitude, her value system to the extent that Peggy's had to. And she may have pursed her lips, but she did it. I'd love to have a look and a listen to some of the key moments that Peggy went through with her children, grandchildren and great-grandchildren. But starting off with one of the reasons that she became such a matriarch, and that is her husband. So Peggy was 18 when she married the farmer's son, Jack Archer, during the war. Jack was the landlord of the Bull from 1952, but he was an alcoholic. And even though this was a time when married women were still excluded from certain professions, Peggy had no choice but to step up in running the pub. The booze eventually killed him in the 70s, but in 2002, we heard a little of what it had been like for Peggy when she treated the 17-year-old Fallon to a glass of wine.
It's too easy to believe drink something special. I know that from experience.
Yeah?
My first husband was an alcoholic.
Oh.
I've been thinking about him a lot this week. He was called Jack as well.
He's the one you run the pub with?
Mm, yeah. Almost 20 years.
Not exactly the best place for an alcoholic to live.
Oh, he wasn't always that way. We had good times as well as bad here.
Yeah?
We enjoyed doing it up. Did you know the Ploughman's used to be two separate rooms?
No.
We had it made into a proper bar and expanded the accommodation upstairs.
Oh, right.
We were so pleased when we finished. Felt like we were getting somewhere.
It didn't work out?
No. I don't know why. Some people can't stop, even when they're hurting themselves.
Living with an alcoholic, what experience did that give Peggy? How did it change her?
I think it probably makes you steely. I think it's the tough love that is necessary to turn people down. I mean, we watch this over again, of course, with Alice and the drinking, and the love wasn't actually quite tough enough a lot of the time. They all put up with her for way too long. So I think that's probably the thing. She learnt steeliness. I think she then went on to apply that steeliness to quite a lot of other things in the family, which is possibly not quite so healthy.
She had three children with big characters, Jennifer, Lillian and Tony. This week in Scotland, I loved hearing Tony and Lillian unable to agree on which of them was Peggy's biggest disappointment. Who do you think won that competition?
I mean, I just think Tony's never been in any doubt about him sort of being a perpetual disappointment. Which is so sad because he's so lovely. and he tries so hard, but I just don't think that bond was ever quite as cemented as it seemed to be with the women.
In 2021, Tom organised a digital birthday card for Tony's 70th with heartfelt recorded messages from all of the family, except for Peggy, whose message for Tony was less effusive. Lillian stepped in to try to soften the blow.
I remember Mum telling me how chuffed Dad was to have a son and how he vowed to mend his ways and look after you. But after a few weeks of you keeping him awake half the night, he was back on the booze.
And that was my fault?
No, of course it wasn't. You know what Dad was like. And Mum, well, it took her a while to recover from having you. Giving birth isn't a picnic at the best of times.
Oh, spare me.
But, well, look, she probably never told you this, but she had a horrible time when you were born. They had to call the doctor in because you had the cord wrapped round your neck. You very nearly died.
And she wished I had.
No, oh, no. She fell in love with you as soon as she got to hold you. And Granny P was there.
And?
So, well, Mum was trying to explain her mixed-up feelings, how she hadn't wanted you, and the doctor was earwigging on the conversation, and he butted in and told Mum it was her having negative thoughts like that that had caused your difficult birth.
Lot to unpack there. Did she treat her grandchildren unequally as well?
It's difficult when you've worked with somebody, because I think that whenever I hear her, you said, you know, you hear that steeliness in her. I hear there being a real kind of vulnerability and warmth in it, as in, you know, she has had to be steely and determined to get through having an alcoholic husband, but also she has an empathy for other people and sort of almost wants to shield them from those mistakes. And I always got that impression rather than the harder one that definitely comes across to listeners. But that's probably because I was in a room with her and I could see her face and I could see what she was doing. So when I would do those scenes with her where she would be telling me off or being deliberately mischievous and, you know, with about Jakob or about the cat or whatever it might be, there was always an undercurrent of looking out for the family and trying her best to be kind and understanding and supportive.
Didn't she promise her house to Helen and then back out of it?
Yes, she did.
And then just back out of it and sell it and use the money to give to dementia in the end.
Yes. Well, like I said, she was a terrible woman.
Let's move on to Jennifer. In 1966, London was swinging with free love, miniskirts and hedonism, but the pill was only available to married women. That year, Jennifer had a fling with Paddy the Cowman and became pregnant. Despite the era's harsh treatment of unmarried mothers, she decided to keep the baby and raise him alone. Her first port of call was the vicar. She asked him to tell her parents about the situation and assumed he was going to be judgmental about her condition.
You thought I'd start to moralise at you, is that it? You expected a sermon, eh?
Well, yes.
My dear, what possible good would be served now by lecturing you on the virtues of chastity? It's a bit late, isn't it? Facts are facts, so let's deal with them. Now, in the first place, I'm sorry, but I couldn't agree to tell your parents for you.
Oh.
It wouldn't be fair either to them or to you.
To me? But it would make things so much easier.
If it would, my dear, I'd do it. But it won't. Whatever I said, however I put it, you would still have to face them sooner or later. I beg you, tell your parents, and those near to you will have to know, as soon as you can. But this I promise you. Once you have made a clean breast of things, then I'll be there to back you up.
It was a long time ago, but you were probably there at the time, Libby. How did Peggy take it? Do you remember?
I do remember the plot running, you know, because obviously I was sort of in and out, as one is, of continuing drama and moving around the place and working. But I do remember the terror. I think I do remember that feeling, and I can see, you know, the Peggys of that generation had to really sort of shape up and accept that they loved their daughters and so on. What did Peggy actually do?
She was horrified. Jack threatened to throw her out. Tony stopped talking to her. She was the talk of the village, and the only person who actually stuck by her was Lillian.
Well, she was. Lillian was always a bit loose around the under things, wasn't she? Yes. The expression used to be not famed for the strength of a knicker elastic, but I couldn't say that on the radio, could I?
You can now. Even it's fine.
I think that sounds better.
Oh, come on, Lillian was always a bit of a tart. Still is.
The interesting thing, though, about Jennifer is that maybe because she'd had to parent Tony and Lillian when she was little and Peggy was running the pub, she was a wonderful mother, wasn't she? I mean, Kate, you can speak to this, Perdita.
I mean, from when I came back from South Africa, which was when I started playing, she was always there creating that home environment for us. And so my memories of Angie are always just in the kitchen area where we record. And she always had a lovely stack of bangles that jangled. And I remember being fascinated by that when we first started working together, because I thought, are they going to tell her to take them off? You know, that's making so much noise for the mics. But it was just, it had become part of Jennifer's noise. Mm. And so she always seemed to be mixing a cake or just doing homemakery type things whilst sighing lots at how annoying we all were.
And a lot of, you know, conversations that Phoebe and Jennifer had were in the kitchen. I remember being sat at the table a lot of the time waiting for her to produce a cake.
Which was why I felt particularly bad when they had to leave the house, because I felt awful going in, even though it was exactly the same piece of set that we walked into. I was like, she's not got the Arga anymore and it's all my fault.
Let's have a look then at Kate and what Kate learned from her granny. Kate gave birth to Phoebe during Glastonbury 98 when she was only 20 years old. The following year, she took Phoebe travelling with her to Morocco, but baby Phoebe got sick and Kate had to return home, where she got very low. Here's the moment she told Phoebe's father, Roy, that raising a child wasn't right for her.
I'm desperate, Roy.
I can't stay in Ambridge. I really can't.
What about Phoebe?
It's not right for her to come too. It wouldn't be fair, I realise that now.
So you're just going to abandon her?
Don't do this to me, Roy. I know I'm not being a very good mother at the moment.
Kate!
That's one of the reasons I'm going. I've got to find out about myself if I'm ever going to be even halfway decent as a mum.
So where are you going this time?
Back to Morocco. I'm using the return half of my ticket. There are people waiting for me. It's for Phoebe's sake as much as mine.
I don't know what to say.
There isn't much you can say. It's my decision.
Are you going to tell Phoebe?
Don't be stupid, Roy. She wouldn't understand.
Well, don't you think she'd like to say goodbye?
This is difficult enough as it is.
In your defence?
I can't, obviously. It's hideous.
It's the me generation. It was quite sharp of the scriptwriters to pick up on that whole feeling of actually it's me that comes first and it's what I am and what I can do, which is now we've gone on and on and on. Mm. You know, it's got worse. But that was sort of the dawning of it, really. And it's interesting. It's social history. It's attitudes. It's people thinking about how other people in different classes and different worlds treat each other. That's why no one should ever laugh at anybody for listening to The Archers, because listen for long enough and you think, ooh, this is Britain creeping past you. You know, slimy bits and all.
I couldn't agree with you more. After Morocco, Kate moved to South Africa. She got married. She had two more children, Nolly and Sipo. Phoebe stayed in the care of her dad, Roy, and his partner, Hayley, who was a very stable stepmother. It was a curious childhood, though. How do you think, Lucy, that it impacted Phoebe?
From my perspective, I think there was always a lot of pressure on Phoebe. I think she was always this... I don't know, goody two-shoes is the wrong phrase, but she was just fine and she was sailing along. And then obviously she entered her teenage years and that's when things started to really get tumultuous. She went to South Africa and she found out her mum was having an affair. And I think then things happened. She obviously went to Oxford and big things were hoped for her. So I think there was a lot of pressure on her, but she had, like you say, Hayley was really stable. And Hayley wasn't afraid to talk about Kate in front of Phoebe. But then obviously that it was really difficult because Phoebe hadn't known Kate. And when she went to South Africa, she still didn't really know her mum. And I think it's only in recent years that she's starting to get to know her properly and she's letting her in. I think she was guarded for a very long time.
She always reminds me, you know, of the character Safi in Absolutely Fabulous, because she's got this wild parent and I feel it's made her straight as a die.
No, I agree. And I think that she had to be. There was so much going on around her that she had her sights set on something and she followed that path.
When you first joined the cast, Lucy, it was 2010. Phoebe was 11.
Yes.
And living with Roy and Hayley. Kate was 32 and living in South Africa. But Kate had just come back to Ambridge to see her family and take her daughter out for a piercing. Let's hear your very first appearance.
Oh, my goodness.
Where Phoebe's caught unknowingly between her mother and her stepmother.
Were you a very brave girl when they did your ears?
Yeah, it was cool. I didn't really feel it, but the place was, like, really amazing and scary.
Hey?
I think you better go up now, sweetheart.
Mum said it was where she had her first tattoo done when she was a teenager.
Did she now?
9 o'clock. Up you go, Phoebs.
All right, night.
Yeah, good night, love. Your ears look great.
I can't wait to show Candice.
Try not to fiddle with them too much, sweetheart.
Okay.
I'll be up. We can clean them before you go to sleep.
Did she say what I thought she said?
She did. I was shocked as well, but I didn't show Kate. Not in front of Phoebs. She was too hyper to notice anyway.
Well, I know that tattoo place. It's by the Cannon Factory. It's where the bikers hang out. It's a real dive.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they'd go to the accessory shop at the precinct.
So, Kate hasn't changed that much, has she?
It is tackling blended families head on, isn't it?
Yeah, that was sort of the theme over the coming years. It was Kate coming back or Phoebe going there and something happening that was out of the ordinary and wasn't the path that Roy and Hayley wanted for Phoebe.
Phoebe grew up in real time, just like baby Peggy is going to. We were all there at her birth and her naming ceremony and her first piercing. You have a nation of 5 million godparents.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
In 2014, Kate's marriage ended. She left her two children in South Africa and returned to live in Ambridge, which meant she was around for Phoebe's sexual awakening. We have a clip, and Lucy, I'm really glad you weren't in the room when this conversation happened, because it's ick. It's the three different reactions of great-granny Peggy, granny Jennifer, and mum Kate on discovering the youngest girl in their family is now sexually active.
Kate, what was all that about?
Oh, Gran?
It's nothing, Mum, it's nothing.
No, Mum's explaining where I've gone wrong. You see, she's so much better with Phoebe than I am, that's why she told her to go on the pill.
Told her what?
Kate, that's enough.
Did you, Jennifer?
No. No, and it's not fair on Phoebe to talk about it anyway. It's her private business. She doesn't even care if they have sex under her own roof.
That is a complete misinterpretation. So what did you say to her?
Mum. Well, go on.
Well, Mum, you know that Phoebe has got a boyfriend. Yes. So all I did was check that she was taking the necessary precautions, should she need to.
And yet I'm the irresponsible one. I don't know how to be a good parent.
Are you sure that was wise, dear?
Yes, of course. Look, I am not going to apologise for having a perfectly mature conversation.
But you don't want to encourage her.
Well, how on earth is it encouraging her? You never gave me a scrap of advice and it didn't stop me.
Jennifer!
I'm interested in whether you think Kate was actually trying to protect Phoebe or if she was just defensive that Jennifer was more responsible than her.
I think that when Kate came back from South Africa, there was almost an expectation that, well, I'm back now and I'd like things to be the way I'd like them to be. And I'm not really interested in how everyone has accommodated for me not being here and the relationships that you've all established. I'd very much now like it to be this way. And so she wanted to be kind of cool and effervescent and fabulous. And Phoebe wasn't really having any of it. She just found her embarrassing. And I think that there was a jealousy in that she didn't like the fact that Phoebe couldn't just instantly go, oh, OK, you're back, so I'll come to you for all of these things now, that she still had a loyalty to the people who had been there. So I think there was a jealousy, but also probably guilt attached to all of that and wanting to make things right, probably.
The thing is, it's such fantastic radio. I mean, listening to that kind of muddle going on. Libby, why do we find moral indignation so entertaining?
Because you like to have different points of view on anything. It is always stimulating. I mean, we're losing this a bit in society now because everyone's got to think kind of roughly the same thing, you know, or else they're just not nice woke people. It is quite nice to hear people saying, actually, that's disgusting.
You're very rude about Kate, but she was at least there for Phoebe at some of the important times. Back in 2016, while Phoebe revised upstairs for her A-levels, her mother and great-aunt Lillian were busy being supportive downstairs.
I popped in to see Jeline early, and Toby Fairbrother was there.
Oh, Lillian.
Trying to persuade Wayne to let him order it as a takeaway.
Oh, don't remind me.
Of what?
You know perfectly well.
Oh, you mean the day the swimming pool turned purple?
Come on, Kate.
That was your finest hour.
I don't know what's got into you lately.
What do you mean?
You're so boisterous.
Boisterous me.
Have you been up to something?
You have, haven't you?
I couldn't possibly comment.
What on earth?
It's Phoebe.
I think it's time we opened another bottle, don't you?
Oh, sorry. That was so fun recording that with Sunny.
Lillian and Kate do get on very well. They're sort of kindred spirits in a way. I mean, you're more like your aunt than you were like your mother.
Yes, she's nice to me. She tries to see the best in things that I do.
And no, you
she...
just join her for a gin.
Well, yes, and we found the best in that situation together. I think you heard us quite clearly.
I think this defines Kate, that she wants to have a partner and a child without being a wife or a mother.
That's a perfect synopsis of
yes. her. Now, Lucy, do you remember what happened in the summer of 2017 with the 25-year-old fruit picker called Constantin?
Yes, I do.
Just give me a little sum up of that.
So of what I remember, Phoebe had a pregnancy scare and an STI scare, I believe. And I remember after that episode was aired, my face was all across a national newspaper about the STI. So that was a bit of a shock in the morning.
What, the Archers has an STI?
Yeah, handle. Yeah, something along those lines.
Amazing.
So yeah. Yes.
Well, when everything went very south for Phoebe with Constantine, once again, it was another woman, Lexi, who stepped in and acted as a mother for her.
Oh, what am I going to do? I can't get pregnant, Lexi. I can't.
It's fine. You're still within the 72 hours, so we'll get you another pill. Will you need to see a doctor?
I know there's a sexual health clinic in Borchester. I think they can sort out everything there.
Good, because I'm afraid young Constantine has been a busy boy this summer, so you should get yourself checked out.
What? Really? Why am I so stupid? Thanks for driving me, Lexi. I don't know who else I could have talked to.
Your mum, Kate, seems pretty cool, no?
It's all a big front. She'd be no good. I'd be better off telling Granny.
Mrs. Aldrich?
Exactly. Dad'd be okay, but just really disappointed in me. He tried to hide it, but I'd still know.
Of course. And your stepmom?
Hayley would be great, except she lives in Birmingham.
So that means that in the list of people that Phoebe might turn to, Kate's currently coming fifth.
Yeah.
After Lexi, Jennifer, Roy and Hayley.
Yeah. And lucky to be fifth, I think.
I think she's probably moved up a little bit since then, maybe.
Yes, I think I'm maybe a strong four now. Yeah.
Do you think there's anything in Phoebe which is that she has to be good because of a fear of abandonment?
Yeah, and I think that she definitely carried that through with her. I also think that there's an element of her parenting Kate, which we've heard throughout the years. There's a strong element of her always thinking that Kate's probably going to leave again, especially when she returned from South Africa. It's okay, well, when are you next going to go? And I think she said something along the lines of that to Kate. She just never really knew when she was going to be left again, so she didn't want to open up to her. She had a family that was grounded and that she could rely on, and Kate wasn't the person that she could turn to at the time.
And Ambridge without Peggy, what's it lost? And what might it gain, do you think?
The cat's still there.
Ugh, Hilda.
Don't like that cat.
I think just to fade quietly away, leave a confusing and annoying heritage and a savage cat. That's the way we'll all be wanting to go, isn't it?
Thank you to my triumvirate of strong women this week, Perdita Avery, Lucy Morris and Libby Purvis. Next week, we have another stormer of a show on Jill Archer's favourite day, Stir Up Sunday, with the food writer Felicity Cloak talking us through Ambridge's culinary highlights, as well as Rewilding's Kirsty and our favourite expert, James Webb, on our favourite subject, the beaver. And finally, we've been asking you to send us any scene you'd like to hear again from The Archers. Your best or worst moment, a scene you haven't heard in years, the moment that made you realise you would always be an Archers listener. In a few weeks, we're going to dedicate a whole show to your favourite moments. So do send us your choice of the most memorable clip on The Archers podcast at bbc.co.uk, or you can send us a WhatsApp message on 08000 289 044. For example, Maggie emailed us to say that she'd love to hear the moment when Awful Tom stood poor Kirsty up at the altar. She remembered the would-be bride on a horse and cart and an ear-piercing wail. So let's hear it. This is particularly interesting to hear this week when Tom so clumsily wondered whether he and Kirsty might have ended up together had their baby not resulted in a miscarriage. Here's a reminder from 2014 of why that absolutely could not have happened.
What right have you got to cry when it's me who's being dumped? Oh, you hadn't got the guts, had you? How could you, Tom? How could you let it go on? You've let me carry on for all this time, months of planning, looking forward, living for this day. Oh, not just that, you encouraged me. You made it bigger. You were the one who upped the guest list. You talked me into Catheridge Hall. And today, all of it, dress, hair, flowers, you've let me parade myself around in public like a fool. Stuck up on a hay wagon, trussed up like a sideshow. Like breaking my heart isn't enough. You had to humiliate me as well.
Flippy, Nick. I've blown it.
When are we going to get our dinner now?
Hello, Kate here. Just to remind you that you can only listen to the Archers podcast on BBC Sounds. So do subscribe and make sure you have push notifications turned on. And we'll let you know as soon as a new episode is available. I've got to go. Jakob is insisting on rearranging my crystal collection and I simply have to put a stop to it.